The tip of the iceberg today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Three former Trump campaign officials are in the spotlight as the first Russia probe indictments are unsealed in Washington. And this may just be the start.
Trump keeps tweeting out, no collusion, no collusion. In June of 2016, his son-in-law, and Paul Manafort met with a Russian emissary who they were told was bringing dirt on Hillary that was part of a secret Russian plot to help Trump. That is collusion.
Plus, the company behind OxyContin takes its marketing overseas.
Going to doctors and saying, no, opioids are safe to be used. Patients can be on these drugs round the clock for years safely with little risk of addiction.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Every day we set out to connect you with the rest of the globe. Easy in the case of our top story today, the indictment of two former Trump campaign officials as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into possible links between the campaign and Russia. Former campaign head Paul Manafort surrendered this morning to federal authorities. He and former associate Rick Gates pleaded not guilty to charges that range from tax fraud to acting as unregistered agents of the Ukrainian government. I asked David Korn, Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones, what these charges have to do with alleged Russian collusion by the Trump camp.
There's not a lot of connection other than Paul Manafort had been working with a Trump ally in Ukraine. And if the Republican platform was changed to be weaker on Ukraine in a way to benefit Russia, there's certainly a connection there that would explain why Manafort would be interested in this. There are questions raised about Manafort's relationship with at least one, if not more, Russian oligarchs. So it gets to connections that Manafort had that are very close to Putin's circle and the Putin regime. But, you know, this is one small piece of this. There was another piece of information out today that has a lot more to do with Trump Russia collusion. A fellow named George Papadopoulos, who was a foreign policy advisor on the Trump campaign, basically has pleaded guilty. And a statement of offense is what it's called, was issued today by Robert Mueller that explained this. And it talks about how while he was on the campaign, Papadopoulos tried to set up meetings between campaign officials and people in Putin's office. And at one point, he came to believe that the Russians had either Hillary Clinton's emails or emails related to Hillary. And so he was very eager to set up this connection. And people who worked with him on the campaign, supervisors and high-ranking campaign officials, encouraged him to do so. They did not say stop. And a lot of this went on after the time it became public knowledge that the Russians were blamed or being blamed for the DNC hacks.
So I just want to get your sense of this. How big a deal are grand jury indictments? Or is there some overreaction going on here on the part of some people who have been waiting for this for months and especially eager since Friday night?
This is a tremendously big deal. You have the former campaign chairman of a presidential campaign being indicted. You have someone who's worked with him, Rick Gates, who is part of the campaign, part of the transition, part of the inauguration, being indicted as well. Both these fellows were known to have been involved in, if not illegal, but, you know, you can call it shady forms of lobbying for decades, at least in the case of Paul Manafort. He has repped many dictators and foreign thugs and was involved with a regime in Ukraine that was known to be extensively corrupt, and he still got the job with Donald Trump. This does reflect on Donald Trump, and the Papadopoulos statement shows that there was indeed an effort to collude with Russia. We knew this already. Trump keeps tweeting out, no collusion, no collusion. In June of 2016, his son-in-law, and Paul Manafort met with a Russian emissary who they were told was bringing dirt on Hillary that was part of a secret Russian plot to help Trump. That is collusion. They tried to collude. And now we see a whole separate chain of attempted collusion where they were trying to set up a back channel communication with Putin's own circle during the campaign, when everyone knew that the Russians were attacking Trump's opponent. And another point, throughout the summer, Trump kept denying, and his people kept denying, that the Russians were even involved in the hack. Now we see that at least on two separate episodes, they were told that the Russians wanted to help them. So to deny that the Russians were involved in the hack, it indicates that they must have known they were lying about that. In any event, it is a big deal. Both developments today are rather significant. I think Trump and his champions are going to try to say, oh, this all happened with Manafort, unrelated to the campaign, and they're going to try to dismiss the Papadopoulos statement. But this is just the start of where we see Mueller's investigation heading. And we know there's just a lot more to be dug up.
David Corn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
By the way, if you want a refresher on how we got to this point in the whole Trump campaign and Russia investigation, we've got you covered. Check out our timeline over at PRI.org. And speaking of timelines, let's go further back in time in Russia to a century ago, because we feel it's important to know the backstory to, in this case, where we're at today with Russia. This year is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, which, of course, gave birth to the Soviet Union. My BBC colleague Steve Rosenberg traveled to the cradle of that revolution, St. Petersburg, to hear how people there recall the drama that unfolded in 1917.
Pyotr Theremin is producing magical sounds on an exotic instrument just by moving his hands up and down near two antennae. The theremin was one of the world's first electronic instruments. Pyotr's great-grandfather Leon invented it soon after the Russian Revolution. Vladimir Lenin was captivated by it. The theremin became a symbol of the Bolsheviks' new world. But it also came to symbolize the tragedy of Russia's revolution. Later, under Joseph Stalin, the inventor was accused of being a counter-revolutionary and sent to the Gulag. More than 1.5 million Soviet citizens would end up in labor camps. There were some positive results of the revolution, concedes Pyotr, like better literacy and electrification of the country. But the Bolsheviks seizing power was a catastrophe. Communism painted Red October as an uprising of workers, peasants and soldiers. In reality, it was a coup, and it would change the world.
The Russian Revolution was the main historical event of the 20th century because it was in the beginning of the century and everything which happened on big scale was a response to it.
Mikhail Piotrowski is director of the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg.
All the Nazi German and fascism was a response to the socialist revolution. The whole development of welfare society in Western Europe and America also was a result of being afraid and let's stop revolution, and they managed.
For such a key moment in history, there are surprisingly few signs of it here. Around St. Petersburg, I can't see any banners proclaiming the centenary, and there are no national commemorations on the scale of a French Bastille Day. Historian Sergei Podbolotov believes that's just the way the Kremlin wants it.
Well, it's a radio silence. The idea of the revolution, let's abolish private property, completely alien for the current regime.
In a St. Petersburg park, hundreds of protesters are demanding free and fair elections. It's a peaceful protest. No one here is seeking revolution. Some of the crowd march towards the city centre. They're chanting, "We are the power here," and "Putin is a thief." Riot police order the protesters to disperse. Then the police start detaining people. 2017 is not 1917. Russia doesn't feel on the verge of a 21st century revolution. Still, with prices rising and real incomes falling, protest sentiment is growing. And that makes the Russian authorities nervous.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reporting there from St. Petersburg in Russia. Let's move on to another era in Soviet history, the Cold War, specifically the part when the world literally lived in fear of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the USSR. Some of us, I'm sure, will never forget those black and yellow aluminum signs often on schools and public buildings. You know, the ones with the three black triangles and a yellow circle? They signaled that nearby was the entrance to a nuclear fallout shelter. Well, the man responsible for those signs, Robert Blakely, just died, age 95. Back in 1961, he was asked by the Army Corps of Engineers to come up with a design for the new fallout shelter program. Harrison Smith wrote Blakely's obituary for the Washington Post.
Robert Blakely at this time was kind of a mid-level bureaucrat in the Army Corps of Engineers. He had worked on about 60 different engineering projects, and he was known as a logistics expert. So he was someone that you would call upon to get a job done, maybe not in building the dam or in engineering this Army Corps structure, but in making sure that it got built in a timely fashion. So he wasn't a designer himself, but when they came to him, he at this point had been through two of the fiercest battles of World War II and the Korean War. He was a Marine veteran, and I think he had a sense of the chaos and the confusion that might result from a nuclear blast. His daughter said that he didn't have a great deal of design experience, but it was at least able to say that we should have something that would help people immediately know where to go in a time of confusion.
So from logistics expert to fallout shelter kind of graphic designer,
yeah.
What was he, I mean, what images were occurring to him? Or was it pretty obvious what he had to kind of draw?
I think, so first off, Robert Blakely actually didn't come up with this image of three triangles. He has been credited with creating the design. His name is on what are essentially patent documents as being the master creator of this signage. But the image of the three triangles actually came about through a firm in Northern Virginia. And what Mr. Blakely wanted was something that was simple and straightforward, that was easily reproducible. His superiors at the Army Corps actually thought that the original signs could go on this material called railroad board or poster board. It was basically just a thick piece of paper that they were going to nail up on telephone poles in cities around the country.
Paper probably wouldn't make it too well in a nuclear holocaust.
Mr. Blakely figured as much. Yeah, paper, not a great idea. Not sure how much better aluminum would fare if a nuclear explosion actually went off next to one of these signs. But at least it was a little bit more sturdy, and he wanted something that would be reflective, like a green street sign that you might see driving down the interstate. So we wanted something simple, and this firm came back to him with a few different suggestions. But one of those designs that they did have is the one that he ended up selecting because it was simple and straightforward. It was these three downward-pointing triangles that sort of suggested the international symbol for radiation, which, you know, is the three bands or swaths that
right.
are organized in a kind of spiral in a circle.
So the fallout shelter sign appeared with numerous pop culture references from Bob Dylan to zombie movies. Did Blakely ever think his sign would be a cultural icon?
I think Blakely just thought he was doing a job, one of many jobs. Part of it was this sense of duty that he was going to deal with whatever problem you put before him. But he really never even talked about the sign. His kids remembered it because he asked them to help in developing the kind of reflective paint that was used on all these signs. But otherwise, it wasn't something he really talked about with friends. He didn't show up in news stories over the years. He was really lost to history until just a few years ago when a Cold War historian, a gentleman named Bill Gearhart, started looking into the question of who created these signs, which, you know, if you were alive during the Cold War, you would have known and probably to a certain extent have feared.
Harrison Smith of the Washington Post, thank you very much for your time.
Of course. Great speaking with you.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Sometimes you hear about towns that thrive on one single industry, like a city somewhere where they mass-produce socks or air conditioners. Our next story is about a village in southern Albania that used to be known for its one industry, cultivating marijuana. Starting in the early 2000s, the village of Lazarat became known as the unofficial pot-growing capital of Europe. And then the pot boom was no more. Nate Tabak went to Lazarat to see what's become of the village.
I've stopped my car in the hills overlooking Lazarat, where the road seems to end and the mountains begin. Soon, a black Mitsubishi truck pulls up. At the wheel, Yetmirgini. He's 36, but looks older, with his weathered face. I get into the back seat. My fixer, Alexandra, rides shotgun. Yetmir starts driving along a flat expanse of rocks. Between the dust and the giant crack in the windshield, it's hard to see much of anything. On the right, he points to an old rusted truck on the side of the road. It's left over from the pot-growing days. For about 10 years, nearly everyone in this village grew marijuana. Lots of it. Including Yetmir's family. Most of that pot went to Western Europe. It was even known by name in Amsterdam. According to police, Lazarat's pot was worth some 4.5 billion euros on the street. But these days, the only kind of agro-business here is the legal kind, and there isn't much of it. Yetmir has been up since 4, tending to his family's herd of sheep in the mountains. It's a rough commute, and it's about to get worse. Yetmir makes a right and starts driving up a mountainside. Soon we reach a clearing, and he stops the truck. We have to do the rest on foot. Yetmir's father, Mato, is waiting for us. He's 66, wearing a gray three-piece suit and a pocket watch. We walk up a rocky hill, just a few hundred feet, but soon we're out of breath.
I'm tired.
We should have gotten water.
Mato hasn't broken a sweat. He's been doing the same walk since he was 15. Albania was communist back then. When communism ended in the early 90s, he bought the sheep and began eking out a living. Soon we arrive at a red-roofed shack. Inside there's a cot. Mato sleeps here most nights, away from his wife, to be near the sheep. An old radio is on, and a friend of Mato's is cooking some corn mush for the sheepdogs. For us, Mato boils some fresh milk from his sheep. These days, this milk keeps Mato's family of 10 afloat. They sell it to a big dairy producer for some $400 to $500 a month. It's not much, but it's better than most people are doing in the village. By some accounts, half the population has left in the past 3 years. Mato takes a seat on the cot next to his friend, also a shepherd. The man doesn't give his name. Most people in the village are reluctant to talk to journalists. It's understandable. Growing pot is illegal, but Mato says they had no choice.
We were the poorest population in all of Albania. What was I supposed to do? I had 8 kids. How was I supposed to feed my family?
By 2010, nearly everyone here was making money from marijuana. Mato's family earned enough to build a $250,000 house, and the government largely turned a blind eye. Albania's former prime minister later said they did it for humanitarian reasons, to alleviate poverty. Lazarat wasn't the only place growing pot, but nowhere was it happening so openly and on such a large scale. And the village protected their income with guns. Lots of them. By 2014, it had gotten to be too much. With a new prime minister and pressure from the EU, the Albanian government sent in an army of police officers. There was lots of shooting on both sides, lasted for days. No one died, but a few people were wounded. Most of that pot went up in smoke, and some 50 people were arrested. Not surprisingly, there's a lot of resentment.
They could have come to us and talked to us in the village meetings. They could have said, "Don't you dare plant cannabis anymore." We would have listened. They didn't have to do it like that.
Mato and his friends say their village was unfairly singled out, but they're glad to be out of the weed business. It was stressful, and they didn't approve of the product. We planted it, but we didn't smoke it, the friend says. Never, Mato adds. They just want the government's help, so it's easier for them to make a living with their sheep. By now, it's nearing noon, and Mato's son, Yetmir, needs to check on the flock up the mountain. We join him. Under a cluster of trees, Yetmir leans back and lights a cigarette. He used to smoke hash, too. He says he stopped for health reasons, but he misses it. He also misses the work.
Cultivating marijuana, you only have to work for 3 to 4 months. You have to tend sheep year-round. With marijuana, you have more freedom to do something else in life. This keeps you away from any friends, everything.
It also keeps Yetmir from his wife and 3-year-old son. He doesn't want his son to follow in his footsteps.
My biggest dream is to educate him so that he doesn't sleep with his head on a rock like I've done. This is the reason I want to provide for my family in the future.
Yetmir isn't sure how he'll do that, but it won't involve growing pot. For the World, Nate Tabak, Lazarat, Albania.
Tomorrow, Nate joins a police officer who patrols the Albanian countryside for illegal pot farms and cuts down all the marijuana plants. Nate's stories from Albania are supported by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Before we go to the newscast, we've got some very sobering news about the global climate crisis. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere hit a new record in 2016, higher than they've been at any time in human history. In fact, higher than they've been in at least 800,000 years. That's the word from the World Meteorological Organization today. The WMO says last year's CO2 spike was 50% higher than the average increase over the past decade, which Secretary General Petteri Talas says is very bad news.
This is demonstrating that we are not moving in the right direction at all. We are actually moving in the wrong direction, and this all demonstrates that there's an urgent need to raise the ambition level of climate mitigation.
The ambition level. In other words, we need to move a lot more quickly to cut our carbon pollution than we've been doing in order to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Talas says it's not too late, but time is running out.
There's hope, but we have to change our behavior in the coming 10 to 20 years to be successful.
The WMO says the effects of human activities on the climate were made worse last year by a strong El Niño. That global weather event brought drought to much of the world and reduced the ability of plants and oceans to absorb carbon dioxide. All of the factors combined to make last year the hottest year on record. And Talas says those super high temperatures aren't the only changes we're causing.
We have changed the climate, and we have seen not only warming, but we have seen changes in the rainfall patterns, drought, flooding, and we have also seen a change in the amount of most intense tropical storms.
Representatives from virtually all the world's countries will meet in Germany next month to work on strengthening the breakthrough climate deal reached in Paris 2 years ago. But under President Trump, the United States, the largest historic climate polluter, has said it's pulling out of that agreement and is working to weaken its climate policies. Today's top news stories are coming up. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Twitter is banning the Russian media outlet RT from placing ads on its platform. RT's response?
This decision is entirely unjustified.
And in Italy, teaching kids not to accept fake news.
We would like really them to become a sort of a fake news hunters.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Last month, Mexico was hit by two major earthquakes. Most of us remember the one that shook Mexico City and the central part of the country on September 19th. It killed more than 350 people and toppled many buildings in the capital. But less than 2 weeks before that, another quake had caused extensive damage in southern Mexico, killing almost 100 people. Reporter Daniel Hernandez went to that part of Mexico to explore another effect of those September quakes, the damage to hundreds of colonial-era buildings, many of them churches with deep importance for residents.
Now we are inside this ex-convent, and really the damage is overwhelming. I mean, entire walls here have come down. It might even be a bit unsafe to be in here, but the extent of the damage is pretty evident.
Daniel joins us now from Los Angeles. Tell us what the quake did to some of these colonial buildings. I mean, we got a taste of it just a moment ago inside that church you were in. What did you see?
Well, really all over southern Mexico, there were severe damages on hundreds of colonial buildings and pre-Hispanic buildings. We're talking about Montalban in Oaxaca, a pretty well-known tourist pre-Hispanic site. Two pyramids there suffered damages. A statue above the Metropolitan Cathedral in Mexico City by the great Spanish-Mexican sculptor Manuel Tolsa also came crashing down. So this was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime event in historic and anthropological terms for Mexico.
So in terms of damage, what stood out the most for you?
Well, for me, it was the churches. By some estimates, hundreds of bell towers collapsed. Many of these were caught on cell phone video. In other cases, the roofs of chapels caved in during the quake. One emblematic case in the town of Atzala, Puebla, a 17th century church collapsed on people who were celebrating an infant's baptism, including the victim. 11 people were killed.
Yeah, it was a really awful case. And some of us may have even seen videos or read about this church.
Right. Most of these are colonial-era churches, hundreds of years old. They really are daily reminders of the total reach of the conquest, which started about 500 years ago and really nearly eradicated indigenous thought. So these are very old Baroque-style buildings. To put it another way, they kind of look in some cases like set pieces from the Game of Thrones, and many of these are really all gone.
So tell us about just one of the churches you visited.
I went to the ex-convent of San Guillermo Abad. This is in the state of Morelos. It was about an hour and a half south of Mexico City. Really, I could have thrown a dart on the map and just picked a town in this part of Morelos. It was one of the hardest hit places in all of southern Mexico. The church that I first came upon and really hung out with all day was a church that was built 483 years ago. Well, that roof of that church collapsed. I spoke with the parish priest, Father Noé Chávez, and he led me through the ruins of the church, and he really seemed very saddened by what he was seeing.
No, pues ahora sí que con esto el pueblo pues pierde parte de su origen.
So he said that the earthquake destroyed parts of the town's origins, its identity, its traditions. You got to keep in mind these churches are also part of a tourism industry. Day trippers stop by. There are annual and monthly festivals honoring certain saints. And Morelos state authorities, in fact, estimate that some 45,000 families depend on the tourism industry that is generated by these very, very old ex-convents and monasteries.
Wow. You know, Daniel, I mean, we're talking the intersection of religious spirituality and natural disasters. I'm wondering if all this led to soul-searching for churchgoers about what the quake symbolized more deeply.
Initially, I think in Mexico, people were more focused, obviously, on the hundreds of people who were killed in these collapsed buildings. But people were wondering what this all means. You know, the church really doesn't have the rosiest history in terms of abuse and exploitation of indigenous populations. There are other people who say, look, this is a part of the world that was once spiritually controlled by a whole nother set of gods, a whole nother cosmology. And maybe some people are wondering the reason why so many of these churches were affected was because there was some kind of cosmic justice at work. I mean, I don't know. And these kinds of disaster and tragic situations, people really are looking for meaning anywhere that they can find it.
It is history, though. So what happens next? Can these important places and sites be restored?
Right now, Mexico's government is putting forth a massive reconstruction effort. These are historically significant buildings registered with the government. They need to be rebuilt. The bishops of Mexico have so far pledged $1 million. The Vatican has also said it will lend some support. But either way, the pressure is going to be on. I mean, in certain parts of Mexico, you were born, you were baptized, you were married, and you are sent to the afterlife in one of these very old historic buildings. So as I'm monitoring the news and I'm seeing that many of these communities are literally demanding that the churches be rebuilt as soon as possible.
That was reporter Daniel Hernandez in Los Angeles. So Oaxaca in southern Mexico continues to recover from two strong quakes, and that has an impact on migration patterns too, because many Central American migrants travel through southern Mexico. And as Levi Bridges reports from Oaxaca, damage from one of those September quakes has complicated their journey. Ew.
The most popular spot at this migrant shelter in the city of Ixtepec is a checkers board. Migrants from Central America crowd around a square piece of plywood, moving plastic bottle caps over squares painted with blue and red nail polish. The competition is tense.
Mentira, ahorita perdió. Ahorita le gané. Joel le ganó.
Come on, man.
Joel Alvarez, a 27-year-old from Honduras, wins this match. The games are a fun distraction from long, boring days. Most migrants standing here fled violent gangs back home. Alvarez took out a small loan to start a furniture business in Honduras. Then a local gang saw an opportunity.
Puro extorsión.
Alvarez says gang members tried to extort him. They asked for about $1,300 a month. More than three times what he actually earned.
Jamás les iba a cumplir, era imposible.
It was impossible to pay them, Alvarez says. They gave him 24 hours to flee the country. Or, he says, they would have killed him. I met Alvarez just before the 8.1 magnitude earthquake that devastated Oaxaca in September. Life here was hard enough already. I visited the shelter again to see how Alvarez and his friends are doing now. This shelter isn't just a place to sleep. Staff members here help migrants get legal immigration status in Mexico. Many migrants are victims of robbery or assault in Mexico, crimes that give them the right to apply for humanitarian visas to stay. But after the earthquake, many state agencies shut down and still aren't operating at full capacity, making it impossible to apply for a visa. Things are starting to get back to normal, but so far, the men and women here have essentially been stuck. Now they may have to wait months to receive legal status. On a recent afternoon, Alvarez helps move beds out of a dormitory badly damaged by the earthquake. Migrants now sleep outside under large plastic tents that make a loud crackling sound when they blow in the wind at night. Standing here, Angel Flores of El Salvador recalls the night the earthquake hit.
This building was shaking a lot, man, so strongly.
Flores also fled insecurity back home. He says the earthquake sounded like La Bestia, the beast, the freight train that migrants ride across Mexico.
I don't know if you have listened to the train when it starts.
Yeah, with the train sound.
The same thing was happening, but inside the land. So it was like...
Every couple days, the train Flores is talking about rumbles past the shelter. Migrants used to ride on top of the boxcars, but today, the train tops are empty. Mexican authorities now patrol the railroad as part of an immigration crackdown supported with U.S. funding. Instead of taking the train here, migrants now walk, sometimes for weeks, leaving them more exposed and vulnerable to assaults. And this shelter, once a well-known place to seek refuge, is now cordoned off with yellow caution tape. All of the buildings are too damaged to enter. Today, volunteers do intakes with new arrivals under a tent outside the office. 27-year-old Felipe Gonzalez, a volunteer from La Porte, Indiana, says maintaining the shelter's basic operations has been a struggle.
Either we have a lot of migrants that are coming in, or everything starts shaking again.
And as Gonzalez and I talk, case in point.
Whoa.
There's a huge tremor that went through that building up there.
Yeah. See? This is what happens, like, on a daily basis. And we just don't know if it's going to be a big one or if it's going to be a small one. But, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big one. Every time one comes, my heart starts beating.
Aftershocks like these have been going on for more than a month now. A constant reminder of the biggest earthquake to strike Mexico in a century. There is some good news. Many migrants have found work. They're rebuilding houses damaged by the earthquakes. As night falls, migrants return to the shelter after work. Some sleep under makeshift tents. The others find space on the ground. Joel Alvarez, the man from Honduras, says the hardest thing is being separated from his 3-year-old daughter.
Yo prefiero que mi hija tenga un padre lejos y no un padre muerto.
I'd prefer that my daughter have a father who's far away than one who's dead, Alvarez says. Because for most migrants here, going to sleep in a disaster zone in Mexico is a much safer option than staying with family in Central America. For the world, Levi Bridges, Ixtepec, Mexico.
Last week, President Trump declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency. Here on the show, we heard about the powerful painkiller OxyContin and how aggressively marketing it to doctors helped start a wave of addiction all across the U.S. because those doctors then overprescribed the drug, which is, as we heard on the show last week, a phenomenon across North America, but not as prominent in other parts of the world. Well, sales of OxyContin are actually down in the U.S. recently. Apparently, now that we're in the midst of this epidemic, doctors have stopped prescribing prescribing this painkiller and others like it quite as much. But something else is happening, too. The family that owns the company that manufactures OxyContin, the Sackler family, is looking increasingly outwards to other countries to market their product. Harriet Ryan has written about this for the Los Angeles Times. So what countries is OxyContin expanding to?
They're moving into the developing world, and they're looking at countries that have strong middle classes with health insurance. So they're looking at China, Brazil, throughout Latin America, and parts of the Middle East and Africa, as well as some of the kind of lesser developed countries in Europe, Portugal, for example.
And are there similarities between how the drug is getting marketed in these places now to how it was marketed when it was first introduced in the U.S. in the 90s?
Absolutely. They're using many of the same tactics that were controversial in the U.S. and that are credited for making OxyContin a pharmaceutical blockbuster here.
Yeah, and remind us what some of those tactics are.
So the first is that doctors have generally a fear of narcotics and of opioids because they know they're so addictive. And so the consensus for generations was that opioids should only be used sparingly and mostly in patients that had terminal illness or cancer where addiction wasn't as big as a concern. And so what the Sackler companies have been doing around the world, as they did in the U.S., is going to doctors and saying patients can be on these drugs round the clock for years safely and with little risk of addiction. It's kind of creating a sea change in the way that doctors think abroad, the way that they changed the way the medical community regarded these drugs in the U.S.
So OxyContin runs into problems here in the U.S. and then it gets marketed overseas. What does that remind you of?
Well, experts have compared it to me to what Big Tobacco did. When, you know, Americans started learning about the cancer-causing properties of cigarettes, they stopped using them and sales fell dramatically in the 80s and the 90s. And the tobacco companies responded by really pushing hard into the developing world where that knowledge wasn't as widely available.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought of, too. But I'm wondering if there are some inaccuracies in the comparison.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, tobacco, cigarettes are not medicine. They're not prescribed by doctors. And there aren't those gatekeepers the way there are for medications. So the advertising campaigns that tobacco companies run in the third world are appealing directly to consumers. And what pharmaceutical companies do when they go into the developing world is they target the medical community. And that's what we're seeing right now is the retraining of physicians in these countries to see opioids as safer than they previously saw them.
I'm wondering, too, now that we have President Trump declaring the opioid crisis a national emergency, will other countries going to like look at these marketing campaigns for opioids with more suspicion?
After our story ran, several members of Congress, I think about 20, who come from places in the United States that have severe opioid problems, wrote a letter to the World Health Organization pretty much begging them to look deeply at the marketing of OxyContin and other drugs in the developing world and to learn from America's terrible experience with these drugs and try to head it off before it becomes a problem in these other countries.
So if the pressure of this national epidemic here and now presidentially declared national public health emergency is forcing Purdue to find new markets for this product that seems to have caused so much harm, does it suggest to you that Purdue senses some kind of responsibility? Like, do you have any solid evidence of that?
Well, the company, the Sackler family owns Purdue and they own these foreign companies, international companies called Mundi Pharma. And they will tell you that they are working every day to stop the opioid epidemic that has developed in the U.S. And the international companies are learning from America's experience. And they will point to the reformulations of the drugs that make it harder for addicts to crush them so they can be more easily snorted to produce a high. But at the same time, when you go to these countries, you know, they're touting the benefits of these drugs without like saying, hey, look what it did to Florida. Look what it did to Appalachia. Look at the rates of babies being born in some American states that are addicted to these drugs. That information is not highlighted in these presentations.
Harriet Ryan with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Facebook, Twitter, and Google are all sending their reps to Washington this week. They're going to testify about how their social media platforms were used as part of a Russian campaign to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The companies have already released some information on that and what they're doing to prevent it from happening again. Twitter announced last week, for example, that it would be banning all ads from Russian media outlets RT and Sputnik, saying that they, quote, attempted to interfere with the election on behalf of the Russian government.
This decision is entirely unjustified.
That's Anna Belkina. She's the director of marketing and strategic development at RT. Now, we've heard a lot here in the U.S. from people who allege that RT tried to interfere in the election on the Kremlin's behalf. But what about RT's response?
Twitter, even in making that decision, has not presented any evidence of this supposed interference.
But RT was purchasing advertisements on Twitter last year, correct?
Correct. Now, our advertising was never targeted towards the U.S. election specifically. And in fact, what's important to also keep in mind about Twitter's decision last week, that came 2 hours, or the announcement came 2 hours after RT started disclosing the presentation, the pitch that Twitter made to RT last May, that was specifically about getting RT to spend big on advertising during the U.S. election. RT rejected this offer. We stuck to our, you know, to our original plan, you know, never focused on any, specifically on any election-related matter throughout the, you know, even the most kind of intense months of the campaign, as overall, you know, throughout that year.
So you continued to advertise on Twitter.
We continued to advertise.
And what were you promoting, your own content?
Yeah, exactly. So we'd publish, you know, we'd publish a story, we think this is, you know, this is an interesting story, interesting RT article. That is something that we would push. But, you know, I was, we actually kind of, in the wake of the Twitter report, went back to see, you know, what the top tweets were that we were promoting during that time period. And we haven't published it yet, but we probably are going to, you know, in the near future in some way. And it's not in any way, you know, it's not in any way election related. And then again, even Twitter itself does not give any particular evidence of what kind of supposed misinformation or RT has, you know, has spread during the election. And yet it conflates our completely legal, lawful, regular, good faith activities with that of trolls and bots.
But
and,
if you have this list of ads you have purchased, why not publish it and let transparency do its thing?
Well, as I said, this is something that's probably going to happen, you know, soon. We're, you know, that's definitely on the table.
So as we've mentioned, there will be these hearings in Washington this week on how Twitter was used by Russians to interfere with last year's election. When it comes to RT, what are you hoping comes up during these hearings?
Well, you know, we're hoping in regards to Twitter, we're hoping that they are truthful about our relationship with them, about the fact that they were the ones who came to us with a, you know, massive proposal, about the fact that we didn't pursue it, about the fact that we've turned down that proposal, as a matter of fact. And we can have sort of constructive kind of conversation going forward.
So, Anna, let me just move briefly away from the story for a minute, although it's kind of a related sidebar, and just ask you about this ad campaign we noticed in the Moscow airport. RT has put up several satirical messages like, missed a plane, lost an election, blame it on us. There's also, come closer and find out who we're planning to hack next. What are you hoping to achieve through this campaign? Because it sounds like you are co-opting the same critiques that we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, I'm really happy to hear that you kind of chuckled while, you know, while reading, you know, reading the messages. First of all, these messages are not about U.S. election specifically, or about U.S. politics specifically. This is a pattern that we've seen kind of all over sort of the Western world, that it's so easy for a politician when something is not going their way to come out and say, you know what? It's because of the Russians don't want me to win. It's Russian propaganda. It's Russian campaign against me. And that's just sort of, you know, becomes kind of, you know, a golden ticket, regardless of whether there's any facts to back that up.
Anna Belkina is head of communications at RT. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And finally today, the Speaker of the House and the Italian Parliament has some strong opinions to share on the topic of fake news.
Fake news are like drops of poison into the water that we drink every day, and we end up infected without even realize it.
That's Laura Boldrini. Her official title is President of the Italian Chamber of Deputies. And she feels that whether it's coming from Russia or anywhere else, the threat posed by fake news needs to be taken very seriously.
This can really change the fate of countries and of democracies. This is why I think institutions have to be involved in this, to give citizens all the tools to defend themselves from what is false. And I think education is the most important tool.
So Boldrini has teamed up with the Italian Ministry of Education to create a curriculum to teach high school students about fake news. The program goes live in 8,000 schools this week. Boldrini says it starts with teaching students the basics of internet news literacy.
Do not share unverified news, because you see many fake news go around just because people like the content of it, but they don't want to know if this is true or not. Or maybe they haven't checked. Also, we tell them to ask for sources, for evidence, before taking any action on a news which is quite strange. Then we also want to remember them that, you know, social networks can be manipulated, so to be aware of the risks involved. So at the end, the project wants also to help students to create their own blogs and also to produce videos where they can expose the false stories, the fake news, and also to explain how they, you know, uncovered it so they can contribute to inform other people.
If that sounds like a whole bunch of homework to your average teenager, Boldrini says the key is letting students work with the same tools they already use anyway.
Because if you, in class, you develop a video or you open a blog on this specific issue, I think it can become a sort of a competition also among the students. And we would like really them to become a sort of a fake news hunters, those who can, you know, be an active part of the internet.
Laura Boldrini, president of the Chamber of Deputies in the Italian Parliament, she helped create a program to teach teenagers how to become, as she just put it, fake news hunters. It goes live in Italian schools this week, and you're hearing about it where else here on the world? Because actually, we could all use a class like this. That is our show this Monday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.